Hello, everyone, and welcome to the New Books in East European Studies podcast series. I am your host, Amanda Jean Swain, at the University of California, Irvine. Today, we'll be talking with Edin Haidarpasic about his recent book, Who's Bosnia? Nationalism and Political Imagination in the Balkans, 1840 to 1914, published by Cornell University Press. Welcome to New Books in East European Studies, Edin.
Thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
And I found your book really fascinating, not least because it seems like everyone wanted Bosnia in the late 19th century. I had not realized it was such popular territory. So Serbian and Croatian nationalists, Ottoman, Habsburg, Muslim, and Yugoslav movements all wanted to stake claim to this territory and to the people living there. But at the same time, they felt frustration with the Bosnian peasants for not living up to nationalists and political imaginations. And Edin makes a number of arguments about how we understand nationalism and political movements in contested spaces, many of which we will talk about in more detail in this interview. But before we dive into the book, I wonder if you could tell us a bit about yourself and how you became interested in being a historian and in studying the Balkans.
Yeah, thank you. And thanks for that nice summary of the book. You know, it's interesting, this question of how I came to it. As I was thinking about that, I realized that actually for a long time, I avoided writing about nationalism as a topic. I had an aversion to nationalist topics, and I think that's pretty common and among people who grew up in Yugoslavia and lived through its dissolution in the 1990s. So I guess I should say that I grew up in Sarajevo and my family left the city in 1992 and then came eventually to the United States. So growing up with the dismembering of Yugoslavia and the war in Bosnia obviously shaped my political consciousness and outlook, but not in ways that directly led me to the book. I think in some ways actually drew me away from these topics initially. So by the time that I came to the United States as a young adult, I was more interested in languages, had a brief, you know, went through a series of obsessions with like Latin or classics and James Joyce at some point and things like this. But in any case, at some time in college, that's when my turn to history began. I think more specifically as a discipline, I realized that there was a lot more to history than simple recitation of facts or their verification, that there are real debates and stakes and arguments and different ways of thinking about it. And that was really useful for me. It's something that I continued to do at the University of Michigan, where I did my doctoral work. And I had a deep interest in anthropology, and that really helped me think of history in a different way, even though I was in the history department. And that's when it was in graduate school that I realized that I want to do something more with Yugoslav histories and with nationalism eventually. Even though at the beginning I resisted this idea of addressing nationalist topics, I gradually began to realize that there is something new to say about this. And in fact, my initial impulse was, I think, quite common for the early 2000s or the 1990s, when there was this feeling that there is a nationalism fatigue, that everything that could be said about nationalism as a phenomenon has already been said in one way or another. I'm caricaturing a bit, but there is kind of a sense in among academia that basically Benedict Anderson has already said everything there is to say about nations as imagined communities. And you can, you know, verify details and modifications, but why try? It seems like it was a phenomenon that was spent in the 1990s and early 2000s. And very few people, even historians, wanted to study it. There was a term to non-national phenomena, national indifference, which I find incredibly valuable and fascinating. And myself, I tried to do that kind of running away from nationalist studies. I studied different communal relations in Ottoman Bosnia. But, and this is getting into the book now, I realized that we as scholars needed to face the problem of nationalism more directly. And I think on one hand, this notion of nationalism fatigue that I mentioned, it's actually quite superficial. And I mean by that, there's this phenomenon that everything's already been said doesn't ask new questions about it. There's always already a kind of conclusion that this is a topic that shouldn't or that could be addressed in deeper detail because already it has been spent. And what really tipped the scales for me is when I started to run across materials in the archives and come up with questions that I had no obvious answer to. When I turned to existing explanations, that's when I started to really go into the phenomenon of nationalism. And Bosnia seemed like an ideal place to do that. It was a province that had been since the late medieval period, ruled by the Ottoman Empire until 1878. After a series of peasant uprisings in 1878 to 1875, was decided at the Congress of Berlin that, among other clauses of that treaty, that Bosnia should be not ruled by the Ottoman Empire anymore, but instead by Austria-Hungary or the Habsburg Empire. At the same time, it was contested by Serbian nationalists based largely around Belgrade, which is by then an independent small state, also by Croatian nationalists, often based in Croatia. So Bosnia is contested first and foremost by Bosnians themselves. I mentioned those peasant uprisings, that there's a long tradition of that and a kind of sequence of uprisings throughout the 19th century. But there's also international contestations, imperial rivalries, and the nationalist contestations. And that's what seemed to me so interesting to study one place that connects to different levels of history on a regional and transnational and transimperial level on a number of ways. And it seemed to me like the perfect place to study for this proliferation of nationalist forms and the compulsion that they exercise on nationalists.
Yeah. And you actually frame your research as exploring what you call nation compulsion. So can you define that term for us and also explain why you think that or why you argue that nationalism was a productive, open-ended force, even in the face of seeming failures to achieve the nationalist goals?
So I think maybe the best way to answer that question and to explain what I mean by the proliferation and compulsion of nationalist forms is to start with and thereby explaining its open-ended nature. I think it would help to start with what I see as a tacit understandings or tacit frameworks for understanding nationalism. So most histories of nationalism narrate how certain elites try to spread their patriotic programs among target populations. These might be certain populations within or outside of existing state boundaries and so on. And in Western Europe, perhaps the most famous account of that nature is Eugene Weber's classic Peasants into Frenchmen, and the title really sums up the story there. Or in Eastern Europe, there's Miroslav Hroch's ABC stages of national development, from elites to populations to mass movements. And of course, these models have been criticized. But what I became interested in is that all of these, even the critiques, have a certain teleology built into them. They preserve the focus on the final outcome of nationalization so that the story usually ends with some sense of stability, you know, either with Frenchmen or Serbs or Czechs or some other nationals clearly established, or with failures like Yugoslavia obvious to us in hindsight. And what I was reading about nationalist works in the archives are gave me a very different sense of nationalist politics. So when I read what Croatian, Serbian, Ottoman, or Habsburg activists were doing, I was struck by how nationalist convictions and developments were far more dynamic and open-ended. I was struck by certain recurring themes that seemed to have been settled or claimed to have been resolved, to have been reopened or constantly under debate. And I was struck by the sense that nationalists in and around Bosnia constantly describe their projects as being on the edge of full completion, but at the same time, hopelessly incomplete, frustrating, and impossible, which only inspire them to develop more projects for a more complete nationalization. So that's when I began to realize that maybe it's better to treat nationalism not as a finite phenomenon that ends with an establishment of an independent state or, you know, codification of a language, or which are major achievements, to be sure, but that there is more to explain how nationalist activists themselves conduct their work and what drives them and what motivates these nationalist projects. So that's when I began to wonder, could we structure analysis of nationalism in ways that did not reinforce this teleological view on the supposed endpoint of nationalist development? Is there such a thing like the endpoint of nationalism? What happens when we approach nationalist works in terms of open-ended processes and not complete aims, or in terms of the compulsion that nationalist forms exercise? So when I talk about compulsion, I don't mean it in any pathological sense, but instead I talk about certain themes that and sites and practices that seem to be recurring and always under debate in nationalist work. So things like the importance of national suffering, even when there are national cataclysms, clear disasters that happen, that may have been happening in the recent or the far past, that this becomes a very important site that is preserved in national memory and in national practice in everyday life. So things like suffering, youth becomes another kind of constant compulsion to talk about youth and the future of the nation. And also, of course, the people itself, the category of defining what a folk or who the people are is something that doesn't have a clear or finite answer. And that's precisely what works in its favor from the point of nationalist activism, is that it's always open for intervention, for debate. It's an endless topic and an endless process. And that's precisely that exercises that addiction, a kind of compulsion to complete it, even though people know that it's not there.
Mm-hmm. And we are going to talk about suffering and youth a little later in the interview, but let's start at where you start at the beginning of the book, with Vuk Karadzic. And he was a linguistic reformer and philologist who supposedly discovered Bosnia and Herzegovina. And even though he never actually traveled to these regions, his work laid the groundwork for what you call ethnographic populism that sought to search out the core of the people in the South Slav lands. So can you tell us more about Vuk and his work, as he was popularly known at the time?
Yes, exactly. That takes us. That's really the subject of chapter one. But you're absolutely right. It sets up certain ideas that come back throughout the book, like ethnographic populism. And in fact, I would say that Vuk Karadzic, the ethnographer that you mentioned, is important to the book in two ways. He provides an example of ethnographic populism in the 19th century, but echoing well into the 20th and to this day. And the other is that his work exposes these relations of othering or alterity, especially around Bosnian Muslim population in Bosnia, which he sees in deeply ambivalent ways, both as brothers through language and others. So let me go through those two ideas, ethnographic populism and othering, one by one. So first, with ethnographic populism, Vuk, as you mentioned, was really, really famous in his day. He lives and works really in the first half of the 19th century. dies sometime in the 1860s. And he's a towering figure, not just in Yugoslav histories. In Belgrade, there's a square and statues of him throughout, or used to be throughout former Yugoslavia. But he's more broadly famous in this kind of romantic awakening movements across Europe, not just in Eastern Europe, in the Balkans. But brothers Grimm celebrate him, learn the Serbian language through him. Ranke, Leopold von Ranke, consults him for his books on the Serbian uprising. Vuk is awarded honorary doctorates by the most prestigious universities in Germany and Russia. His works are translated into English and French and so on. This is all in the first half of the 19th century. And much of that fame rests on his accomplishments in the field of linguistics and in folklore. So he is famously the father of the Serbian language. He standardized the Serbian grammar, including things like spelling, wrote the first modern Serbian dictionary. And he, in doing all these things and collecting folklore, he claimed that Herzegovina in particular, but Herzegovina and Bosnia, which are the two territories in modern-day Bosnia and Herzegovina, he claimed that Herzegovina in particular held the purest language and folklore in all the South Slavic regions, from roughly what is today Slovenia down to Montenegro and as far south as Macedonia. That's the area that he claimed all spoke a version or different dialects of Serbian. And he said, yes, there are many different dialectical differences, but the purest form that we should base our national language on is located in Herzegovina. That's where the language among the peasants, of course, has been preserved. That feeds into this romantic myth of the pure, you know, remote, unspoiled peasantry of, you know, this kind of romantic myth. And as you mentioned, that he promotes this, that the Herzegovine, the so-called Herzegovine dialect, does become the standard for a joint Serbo-Croatian language by 1850, with the Zagreb Agreement in 1850. And what's interesting about Vuk is that he never quite goes to Herzegovina or Bosnia. He claims a lineage from this region through his family, which does come from a border area between Montenegro and modern-day Herzegovina. But he's born and raised in Serbia. He, in fact, spends most of his life in Vienna collecting this folklore through some field work, but also through visitors to Vienna and through publishing. And what he really upholds, and that's why he's important for that first part of my answer, ethnographic populism, his own journey is really important. His biography is really important in illustrating how one could become a patriot. Because Vuk comes from humble backgrounds, from a Serbian village, and goes on to Vienna to become the leading philologist of his era. Now, that itself, that kind of narrative arc from peasant to ethnographer is something that a lot of people will try to replicate and say that's what we should be doing, is going into the people, going into the folk to learn its ways, to learn its customs, to learn its folklore. And of course, as Vuk's own example of Herzegovina suggests, that's an unreachable goal. Many people may go into the folk, may go into the people, but always leave that work unfinished and open-ended, because the burden then returns for you to complete that work, to go back and get more sayings, more proverbs, new words. So what he does establish is a kind of really both a model of self-fashioning of himself as an ethnographer and as a kind of a populist, so that he, in a quite typical romantic gesture, says, you know, all these learned academies are so far removed from the real people, from the peasants, and they speak in words that are not understood plainly by ordinary folk. So that there's a kind of condescension to the learned aristocracy, especially. But then he says, we also need a new science, a science of the people, and that's ethnography. And everyone can do that. Everyone can collect proverbs, essentially. Everyone can learn folk poems, epics, and so on. So that's the ethnographic populism that becomes really important and is later imitated and adopted in certain ways by the Habsburg Empire itself to promote a rival claim to Bosnia by collecting folklore, for example, from Bosnian Muslims. And that's when I want to mention this as just as a second part, because that's the other kind of running thread through the book. Vuk, when he talks about Bosnia and Herzegovina as being the lands of the purest language and folklore, he quite consciously and explicitly says that this is a language that's spoken by South Slavs of all three religions, Orthodox, Catholics, and Muslims. He, in a typical gesture, again, of early 19th century nationalism, leaves out Jews and Roma or other religious or ethnic groups. But he says these are the three core religions that speak the same language, which he calls Serbian. And he says even Muslims who speak a language that has absorbed a lot of Turkish words, in fact, they speak a very pure form of Serbian, that there are brothers on the one hand, because their epic poems are identical to those of the Orthodox and Catholic groups as well. And on the other hand, Vuk is also engaged in an anti-Ottoman, anti-Turkish crusade. From his upbringing, he takes part early on in the Serbian uprising before ending up in Vienna. He is very staunchly anti-Ottoman, anti-Turkish in many of his writings, in his proverbs, are littered with all sorts of anti-Turkish sentiments about Turks being devious, murderly, and hostile to Christians, oppressive, and so on. But if you look at his dictionary, and that's when I introduced this term, BR other, so it's brother, but with BR in parentheses, so that you can read it both as brother or other. In his dictionary, he collects all these Serbian words that he says are Serbian, but some are clearly of Turkish origin. And he says, we will replace those later. But in the meantime, there is no replacement for them, even though they're Turkish. So we will mark them with an asterisk, these Turkish words. And at some future point, we will replace them because we really should have a pure Serbian language. So you see this very ambivalent attitudes. On the one hand, a rejection, exclusion, but on the other hand, a practical inclusion. In fact, Vuk Karadzic's own last name, Karadzic, if you look up the word Kara in his dictionary, it also holds an asterisk because it's derived from the Turkish word for black. So in a way, he has marked his own heritage for future erasure. And that's what I found so fascinating and had gone really unremarked in most of these accounts, which really kind of come down in a dichotomy. It's either us or them. Lines of exclusion are drawn pretty firm ways and hard ways. That's not at all what I found in my research. And that feeds into this open-ended feeling of nationalist activism in which the brother can be read both ways, as a co-patriot, as a co-national, and as a figure of insurmountable difference.
And it's very convenient, fortunately, that brother and other in English actually
yes.
come together. It makes me curious. I want to go look up the etymologies of those words, but not right now, because we have another topic to talk about. And I did find the chapter, The Land of Suffering, in your analysis of what you called aggrieved nationalist subjectivity, particularly compelling. And activists were crafting a narrative of Slavs suffering under the Ottoman yoke. But why were these activists so heavily invested in the sad Bosnian motif?
Yeah, that's... So the book is structured in a way to emphasize these certain themes. that became sites of nationalist compulsion and proliferation of discourses. So the first one that I talked about is this theme of the people. So I call the first chapter is called the Land of the People. And the second is the Land of Suffering, and introduces a number of these paradoxes in the development of nationalism. So while on the one hand, Vuk is spreading this idea of Bosnia being the land of the people, of the purest folk, where the purest language is spoken, at the exact same time, in the early 19th century and continuing well up until 1914 and echoing into the 20th century, there is a widespread idea among Serbian, Croatian activists, and it becomes later on adopted elsewhere across Europe, that Bosnia is a land of really deep suffering. In the first place, the suffering of Christians in the Ottoman Empire, in Ottoman Bosnia in particular, at the hands of the Turks, who rule the land and inflict suffering upon its Christian raya, the raya being the term for really subjects of the Ottoman Empire, but it has, because most of the subjects in Ottoman Balkans are Christian, it becomes synonymous with meaning Ottoman Christians themselves. So that the suffering of the raya becomes a really amazing concern for poets, diplomats, painters, budding activists, budding politicians across the Balkans. How does this work in practice? Well, in the first place, what surprised me about all of this is that I kept coming across in the archives and in as I was reading books and newspapers of the early 19th and late 19th century, I kept coming across these poems and essays that had all these allusions and wordplays on the title Sad Bosnia. And it never had occurred to me that this was a thing in the 19th century. And I have to say, taking notes by hand in the archives or while reading newspapers was really helpful because, you know, by the time you write like Sad Bosnia in a number of different ways, you realize what's going on here. Why are people so invested in these discourses of sadness? And just as a side note, I'm a huge fan of still taking notes by hand. I think historians are probably the last researchers who will give up handwritten notes. Anyway, Sad Bosnia, I came across all these references, and I began to investigate, when does this term begin to appear? In the late 1830s, really in 1839, and it's continuing through the 1840s and 50s and 60s, through poems that dwell on the general sadness of this province, because it's the only South Slavic province by that point that is perceived by activists in places like Belgrade and Zagreb to be unawakened and to still be the last major province not to be liberated. So in the Habsburg Empire, Croatian nationalists, or Illyrian nationalists, as they would call themselves in the early 19th century, would look across the Sava River separating Croatia from Bosnia and say, you know, our brothers are across that border, but there rules the Turk. Similarly, to the east of Bosnia, in Serbia and Belgrade, people might, budding nationalists, would look across the Drina River and say, well, look, you know, those are our brothers across those rivers, and we can hear their cries. And what struck me about this is that often these poems would be written without a clear point of reference. It's later there will be specific mentions of massacres and particular events. But what struck me is that this was a kind of generalized sadness that to be a nationalist is to speak from a place of injury to your people, and that your people are aggrieved, they're abused, they're oppressed by the Turks of all people. That this is a very important point in the early beginnings of this discourse is that it's a violation of a Christian, otherwise civilized people by an inhumane, brutal Turkish rule. And the really key epic that summarizes these themes is the death of Smaila Çengiç, which is written in the 1840s by Ivan Mažuranić, a Croatian then poet who goes on to be a Croatian governor by the 1870s in the Habsburg Empire. And really, it's this epic that makes his name as both a poet and a kind of Croatian patriot. What he does is he writes a poem about a real historical event in which a group of Montenegrin Highlanders killed a prominent Ottoman Bosnian Muslim landlord, Ismail Aga Cengic, in Herzegovina, on the border between Herzegovina and Montenegro, an event that happened to take place in 1840. 7 years later, he composes this poem that takes this real historical event, but endows it with a kind of exalted air of suffering, of really lengthy scenes of the landlord, who is depicted not only as a vicious, a greedy Turkish overlord oppressing the Christian Raya, but the scenes dwell more on the kind of soundscape of the sufferings, the cries, the silence of the scene as the Raya and some of the captured Highlanders are impaled in very lengthy scenes, and punished, beaten, and so on. And this book, it becomes a huge hit of the 19th century. It's translated into 30 languages by the middle of the 20th century, including there are two translations in English. It's taught in gymnasia all across the South Slavic-speaking world, in Serbia, Croatia, Bosnia as well. And it continues to be taught well after Ottoman rule ends.
Mm-hmm. And that's actually my next question, was that, you know, there's all of this horrors of the poor Christian Slavs under the Ottoman Muslim Turks. But then when the transfer from Ottoman rule to Habsburg rule, the nationalists still are able to figure out a way to frame this narrative of national suffering. So, yeah, continue on.
Yeah, that's exactly what I describe in the book, is that the Ottoman rule ends in Bosnia in 1878. Austria-Hungary occupies the province. Many of the Croatian nationalists are initially pleased by this turn of events, thinking that it will bring Bosnia closer to Croatia in the long run. Serbian nationalists are less enthused, but what struck me about this notion of suffering is that it doesn't go away with the end of Ottoman rule. Nationalists continue to reprint and comment on Smaila Çengiç, for example. There are various debates by the late 19th century whether the epic is a forgery, whether it's a fantasy, a kind of blown up, exaggerated event. And what's really surprised me when I looked into it is that the consensus was that, and the word itself was used, that fantasy is essential to understanding history, a real historical event. Fantasie being a kind of, even in German, a term that connotes more the capacity for imagination and recreation of an event, to endow an event with real significance rather than just verification of event of facts. So that impalement scene, for example, that was so vividly described in the epic, it turns out that Ivan Mažuranić's son is asked to basically vindicate his father, and who's dead by then, and say that this was real. And he writes to a number of ethnographers, figures in Bosnia, who write back and say, that's really did not happen. The impalement is not the kind of It was not an event that would have really transpired. Nobody remembers this, but it's inscribed in national memory, and it is, in some sense, more accurate than what actually happened, because it conveys the point more clearly. And that's the point of fantasy, is to convey the essence, the gist of history, and not the mere dry facts. And that's what was so important to nationalists and the idea of fantasy being able to convey the essence of suffering, which continues in the Austro-Hungarian period. Conveniently, there is a switch that happens gradually, but pretty clearly by the beginning of the 20th century, in which the old Turkish time, which was once decried as the most inhumane rule that humanity has ever seen, is quickly replaced in a matter of a decade by the notion that Austrian rule may be superficially less violent. In fact, it isn't outwardly violent, but it's stifling. In the words of one poet, he writes, the Turks punish the body, the Austrians punish the soul. So that there is always an injury, even if it's spiritual and removed from a physical injury, but that the national spirit speaks from a place of grievance. And that's when I talk about these examples of Petar Kocic and his reimagining of the Bosnian peasant, not as someone who speaks purely, but as in the case of Vuk, but as someone who is downtrodden, who can barely speak, and who's so deadened and muted by history that nationalists must speak up for him and for the millions of others, silent, suffering souls. And suffering in that way, I realized, is really a very unexplored topic in the history of nationalism. It's usually a topic that philosophers have written about, from Foucault to Vina Das to Susan Sontag. But historians, particularly of nationalism, have often dismissed these accounts either as a kind of exaggerations, as narratives of exaggerated victimization, divorced from reality, or they'll treat them with some empathy and say, well, this is really reflects some kind of real pain. But in either case, it tends to simply abandon this huge cultural production that includes not just epic poems that I talk about, but painting, diplomatic debates over the value of the suffering. It even filters into discourses of people like John Stuart Mill, an absolutely central figure in the history of modern liberalism, who writes about this irresolvable conflict between the Muslim Turks and the oppressed Christian Raya. So suffering to me then became a kind of way to link nationalist causes with the broader web of the rise of liberal humanitarianism in some sense in the 19th century.
Hmm. And the next kind of big thing to happen was the establishment of the Serbian state. So how did that new state within the lands of the South Slavs transform the activists' perception of their work? And why were secrecy, insurrection, and the expansion of potential co-nationals considered the key strategies?
So the book moves in these thematic ways, but also chronologically, obviously throughout the 19th century. And you're quite right to emphasize the rise of the Serbian state, which I had already mentioned earlier as being an important focal point. But really, in chapter three, I take up the challenge of looking at why the Serbian state becomes a magnet for national activism in the Balkans in the 19th century, and what kind of national activist practices were developed in this state over the course of the long 19th century up until 1914. And initially, because Serbia is, before 1878, still technically autonomous, not independent, it's an autonomous principality, much of its much of its ideas of expansion to nearby neighboring areas have to be held under wraps. So the first major plan for Serbia's expansion is the famous Nacrtanje, or simply called plan, by Ilija Garašanin in the 1840s. This is really the era of such plans of expansionists or irredentist nationalism in the 19th century. We have the Megali there in Greece as well, similarly dreaming of future expansion. But for reasons of diplomacy and to prepare for future expansion, Serbia cannot outwardly appear as a threatening state that is going to attack either the Ottoman Empire or the Austrian Empire. So that essentially many of these plans have to be held in secret. There should be a network of agents ready to spread the word about Serbia's glory and progressive role in liberating peoples around the Balkans. And then those people, those peasants will rise up. And that's where the insurrection comes in. The problem with this, with all this planning, and from the 1840s really up to the 1870s, up to 1878, could be called the golden age of these plans for insurrection. So what I found in the archives and in Belgrade, for example, is dozens and dozens of agents or activists' plans for an insurrection in Bosnia, that national activists, both local ones and ones from outside, from Serbia and Croatia, would come in and tell the peasants to rise up and overthrow their Ottoman overlords. That doesn't quite happen. And in fact, the mission is quickly revealed to be not one of insurrection, but one of instruction. And that's the key, I think, to this dynamic, is that the relationship is always structured as being that of a conscious national patriot who speaks to an unawakened or partly conscious or liable, you know, a very pliable co-national that is not aware of his role in the future of the nation. So that even the idea of instructing them to rise up becomes one of a relationship of essentially tutoring and a form of instruction that is incompletable. It becomes a kind of a gap in which nationalists always are disappointed in their co-nationals, who can never quite live up to the ideal that they're supposed to fulfill. So what I really kind of wanted to show in that chapter is that disappointment is not and failure are not by, you know, kind of accidents and byproducts in the development of nationalist ideologies, but are actually quite central. And that's what's important to grasp about them, is that disappointment is one of these driving forces, a compulsion of sorts that compels these nationalists to always treat their co-nationals as somewhat lacking in the true patriotism, as never living up to the ideal of what it is to be a true national.
Yeah, and that ability to hold these contradictory beliefs is actually one of the very interesting parts of the book, or, you know, arguments within the book. And you mentioned at the beginning the youth, and nationalist activists in the late 19th century were trying to figure out if and how to mobilize youth as a political force. So how did they view youth and nationalist activity directed toward the Bosnians? And also talk about this intersection of youth heroism and violence in the Balkans.
Yeah, so this this disappointment that nationalists feel towards their supposed co-nationals is often apparent, especially in their treatment of the next generation of patriots, namely children and youth, who are a constant obsession of nationalist work. often for quite generic reasons. I mean, you know, the future of the nation, our youth, could be pretty much the slogan of every nationalist movement that I've encountered. But I think the problematic is a bit more interesting than just that kind of generic notion. What I found interesting about these youth movements is that there is a kind of uptick in organization of youth societies, of societies that call themselves young, across Europe in the 19th century and in the Balkans in the late 19th century, that is quite specifically modern and is not simply just a kind of reflection of this generational shift, this kind of never completed horizon that youth are supposed to fulfill, but it signals a kind of shifting attention to youth as a potential element that could break apart certain dilemmas that, and these contradictions that you mentioned that these nationalists have to live with in the 19th century, that one of the ways of resolving them is to displace them and to, or to rather project them onto the youth as being the element that will be able to resolve. So the tension between suffering and liberation, between being a proud people and being humiliated, between being a small state and between being, in their own minds, perceived as a great people, a massive group, and so on. That the next generation, by the late 19th century, the consensus is kind of reached that the next generation will be able to break through with all of this and actually realize a future that we can only dream of. And what I became interested in this is how this tied into one particularly famous formation of this of these youth discourses, and that would be the Young Bosnia movement in the early 20th century, that is often linked with the Sarajevo assassination, which itself becomes a point of rupture that seemingly fulfills with the end of the First World War, at least some of these kind of dreams of national unification, at least for some, not for others, of course. And what I became interested in looking at this is that I realized that many of these national activists were writing about the future in ways that were really difficult to simply dismiss as anachronisms, that somehow we read 1914 back into these histories, that all of this kind of culminates in a great eruption with World War I. But what I found interesting is that there was a sense that among nationalist activists, especially in Serbia and Croatia, in the early 20th century, that the Bosnian youth are somehow able to capitalize on and condense the suffering of their people and express it in a particularly condensed, heroic form that will revolutionize the world. So one of the actors writes about, you know, he's writing this in 1912, we're living in anticipation of year X, a year that is unlike any other years. And for us, it's easy to read that as 1914, but of course, he did not know in 1912 what was going to happen in 1914. And that's that tension and that kind of anticipatory horizon of expectation, to use Reinhard Koselleck's work here, that made youth such a potent site of nationalist activism, particularly in Bosnia.
And another thing you mentioned at the beginning, so I'm actually feeling kind of good because I clearly picked the key topics to ask my questions on, was the fact that the Habsburgs published seemingly national newspapers and materials such as the journal Nada. And I was really surprised that by this response of the Habsburg Empire to nationalist activism in Serbia and the South Slav lands more generally. So tell us more about that.
Yes. So just as you said, to kind of tie these themes together, this expectation of a great upheaval in Bosnia is not unnoticed. In fact, it becomes a great source of concern for the actual administration, for the actual government of Bosnia, which is, after 1878, a provincial Habsburg administration, which is looking at Bosnia as a province that has been, on the one hand, and they use this word with quite positive connotations in their eyes, pacified. So a land that used to be full of peasant unrest in the Ottoman years has been largely put under control. It's a formerly quote-unquote Oriental land with a very large Muslim population that is now led into a brighter future, supposedly, under the Habsburg Aegis, under the protection of the Habsburg monarchy. But the problem with all of this is that the Habsburg administration looks also at Bosnia and sees quite clearly that Serbian nationalists are obsessing over the suffering and the oppressed people of Bosnia, so that they're quite disconcerted that what the Habsburgs see as an era of modernization, progress, uplift in Bosnia, is being subverted by these national activists who are claiming that, no, in fact, what is happening here is that the Habsburgs are still oppressing the people can't speak, the people can't breathe, it's a stifling rule, and the youth themselves are particularly seen as dangerous. So what the Habsburg government does is, on the one hand, they strictly monitor these nationalist formations, especially societies. They do not want nationalist teachers in schools, though invariably some do end up in schools. They don't want incendiary writings to be spread in Bosnia. So there is a fair bit of, if not of, censorship, but in ways that sort of act sometimes indirectly or pressure certain journals not to be too incendiary. So on the one hand, the Habsburgs are really concerned that these discourses of national sufferings are damaging to the Habsburg reputation. They take up a campaign to provide a picture of a better Bosnia, a Bosnia that is a land that is, first of all, not suffering, but it's a land that is also charming, idyllic. Its geography, its folklore are supposedly spectacular, so that the government actually uses, the Habsburg government starts to use the very same parts of the very same tropes of nationalist discourses to treat Bosnia as an unawakened land that has now been awakened by the modern Habsburg spirit and is flourishing as a result. So Bosnia is seen as a kind of a sleeping beauty province, formerly Oriental, but now being able to fulfill itself. The journal that you mentioned, Nada, is sponsored by the Habsburg government up until the early 20th century. And it's lavishly illustrated with photographs, paintings, poems about Bosnian folklore. Ethnographers are handsomely subsidized to collect Bosnian Muslim folklore and celebrated as a Habsburg achievement that belongs to the people. And they actually quite explicitly say, this is what Vuk never did. He never managed to go to Bosnia and Herzegovina. He himself said that this is the land of purest folklore, and who is able to make this folklore known to the world? It's the Habsburg government. Far from oppressing nationalism, we're actually fulfilling its true needs, its true mission. So to me, this was important, that this kind of imperial adaptation of nationalist forms was really important part of the book to explain the proliferation of nationalist forms. I think it's quite common, especially among historians of Eastern Europe, but I think elsewhere in the Middle East as well, to treat and automatically assume that nationalism and empire stand on opposite poles, that's of politics, that it's nationalist movements that are trying to break away from empire, which are dynastic, essentially early modern legacies, somehow outdated and by the beginning of the 20th century. And the picture is quite the opposite. In fact, nationalist and imperial forms of politics learn from each other over the course of the 19th century. They study how each other's camps, even though they might see them as opposites, but more like rivals. It's seen more as a competition on the same field. So not as different versions of politics, but variations on the same form of modern politics, so that empires, particularly the Habsburg and the Ottoman Empire, I talk a bit about the Ottoman government's use of Vuk's standard grammar, for example, in Bosnia. They're quite happy to adapt it. I see these as signs that these empires were, first of all, not outdated, early modern, you know, vestiges or somehow artifacts of a bygone age, but in fact, quite vital political enterprises that were willing to learn and use new tricks. So the government would use a journal like Nada. It will sponsor international exhibitions, including the exhibition in Paris, visited by some over 50 million visitors, the World Expo in Paris, where the Habsburg government establishes three pavilions, one for Austria, one for Hungary, and one for Bosnia. So the dual monarchy actually has three pavilions, one separately for Bosnia because it has a special status. And it's the famous painter Alphonse Mucha who provides this idyllic image that actually graces the cover of my book, of Bosnia as a kind of land of pastoral, idyllic, untamed beauty.
And it is a beautiful cover, so good selection. And you begin the epilogue by acknowledging that any history of nationalism in Bosnia must deal with questions about current ethnic divisions and the violence of the 1990s in the former Yugoslavia. So how do you address those questions?
Well, I think first the way I address that question is by calling attention to the fact that there is an implicit expectation today that history of Bosnia must somehow be able to explain what happened in the 1990s. And the answer, I'm afraid, is that history does not repeat itself. history works in ways that don't add up in neat ways. So that while history can tell us something about the reappearance of these othering, brothering relations in the 1990s, I don't think that it can explain in a conclusive way why violence in particular happens. In fact, that would be my argument, is to say that violence deserves to be a separate topic that isn't covered in this book, but that I would have more to say in a different study if I were to undertake it. But I think that by looking at 19th century and early 20th century Bosnia gives us a different sense of what's happening in the long term, what's happening in the long durée, not just in the Balkans, but I think worldwide when we study nationalism. And the way I sort of structured some of the comparisons in the epilogue is to say that there is an expectation not just that history helps explain the wars in the 1990s, but that there is a twin expectation that the wars of the 1990s, the ethnic cleansing, the genocide in Bosnia, were somehow the end of the story. And I think that's quite frankly wrong. History does not end there. And in fact, nationalism and nationalist forms of politics don't end with genocide or ethnic cleansing. That somehow this expectation that if the boundaries, however violently, could be redrawn and each people Bosnian Muslims, Serbs, Croats, Albanians, whoever, got their state, that would lead to some kind of a settlement. I think that expectation does not quite understand what's at stake in history and what's at stake with nationalism. To me, that expectation that somehow if these boundaries can be redrawn, however violently, in it's akin to that quite common analogy of a puzzle that people are trying to put together, that you have a very complex area with different communities, allegiances, polities, and somehow that you can maybe fit the puzzle pieces and the colors, obviously, in solid areas, somehow that will lead to a picture that might not be beautiful, but it will be a stable picture. So, and in fact, what I found fascinating is that puzzles as a form of entertainment, the first puzzle, in fact, was a map of Europe with countries. And there is this kind of, I think, completist paradigm that I've been criticizing and addressing in my work, that people expect somehow violence in the 1990s is getting us, you know, it's deplorable, it's awful, but it's getting us closer to quote unquote resolving these issues. First of all, it doesn't resolve them. That relationship that I mentioned at the beginning between assimilation and inclusion on the one hand and exclusion, violence, rejection on the other, it's a much more complex relationship that I try to capture in that ambivalent term, an ambiguous term, be our other, a kind of endearing imperative that I coined there. And I think that relationship reappears after the war, after acts of genocide. It's not that now we know who's a brother and who's the other. Those questions are never settled. And I would suggest, and that's what I end the book with, is that we should stop thinking of nation building in terms of puzzle pieces. The puzzle piece analogy is fundamentally flawed on a number of different ways. If we do have a conception that is closer, it would be one of Tetris, where it's not the puzzle pieces of nationhood, but Tetris, which is a game that is built on a no-win condition. You can align certain units into a uniform row, and there is a brief moment of satisfaction, but those rows then disappear. And what you see on the screen is the jagged irregularities, the incomplete pieces that are driving you to fit more pieces together. And the Tetris ends always being overwhelmed and restarted. And I think that's much closer to getting us to realize that there is no end to nationalism. Violence can never be excused as kind of deplorable but necessary for settling political disputes, but that these disputes are in this way irresolvable, like Tetris.
I think that's a very good analogy. I was in my mind envisioning playing Tetris and how often it did end with me just restarting the game. and I really appreciate, you know, that thoughtfulness and what can history teach us about the present, or what can it, you know, what does it not teach us, and what can it teach us? So, well, thank you very much for being willing to do this interview and giving so much of your time, truly, since we had a false start and managed to reschedule and have another false start, but get going this time. So we really appreciate the opportunity to hear more about your book. And I'd like to end by asking you, what are you working on right now?
Right now, I'm still finishing up a few things related to that kind of came out as tail ends of my research from the 19th century. So a few things on Muslim education in the Balkans, with Bosnia as an example. But I think that the problem of elementary school education, the so-called mekteb, is really an important one that I had wanted to address in broader ways as a kind of history of this idea of Muslim exceptionalism. that Muslims constitute a population that has to be addressed, even in educational terms, in different ways. And I think it has profound consequences for histories of Balkan societies and more generally European Muslim societies. The other is another article that I have been working on for a while, but I realized that I never published and I should really dust that off, on Bosnian Franciscans and their position, and so Catholicism in the Ottoman Empire. But really the big next major project will take me into the interwar period, when I'm looking at different, it's a more transnational history that has to do with certain, let's say, groups or individuals that end up fostering new networks of both converts and existing Muslim groups in places that we don't normally connect. So there are certain Yugoslav-born Muslim intellectuals that end up in Spain briefly before ending up in places like Paris and Berlin, at the same time working with both indigenous Muslim populations, but also new converts to Islam in the interwar period. And it just struck me that this is a really fruitful way to address this kind of question of rediscovery of Islam as both a European religion and as a kind of insurmountable other in the interwar period in interesting ways. It's probably going to be a micro history of some sort. I'm not sure at this point whether it's going to be several individuals or one individual story, but that's what I hope to be doing more of. If I get a research lead, it'll go faster. we shall see.
Well, good. Well, I look forward to that book coming to fruition at some point, and I hope you'll keep the New Books Network in mind at that time, and maybe we can do another interview.
Oh, certainly.
But in the meantime, I also want to thank our listeners for joining us in this podcast, and we look forward to next month's conversation about a new book in East European Studies. So thank you, Eden.
Thank you for inviting me.